And welcome to Through the Pinard, your conversational podcast talking to midwives around the world about the research they are doing to improve midwifery practice. This research can range from small quality improvement programs and projects to those starting partway through or just finishing their postgraduate studies, and to those that have been there, done that, and got the t-shirt. So settle back and enjoy the conversation. And remember, you can continue the conversation on Twitter after you finish listening. Thank you very much for joining me. As per usual, can you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Bupe Mwamba, and I have a background of nursing and midwifery. And so I started my midwifery journey as a nurse in 2002 in Zambia, where I did my training at Lusaka Schools of Nursing and Midwifery. And then after that, after finishing my training, I did my internship just there at the University Teaching Hospitals in Lusaka. And after finishing the internship, I was placed in the neonatal intensive care unit. And so it is in the neonatal intensive care unit where my passion for midwifery started. So it developed in there. And because if you're working in the neonatal intensive care unit, you meet a lot of mothers in the puerperium. And so my interactions with the mothers made me get into midwifery because it was the closest specialty then in Zambia. And so I went to study midwifery after working for 3 years in the neonatal intensive care unit. And so just to beef up the knowledge and the skills that I needed as I cared for babies in the neonatal intensive care unit. And probably even in training, I received the best obstetric nurse when I was training as a registered nurse. And because when you look at training in low and middle income countries, in Zambia to be specific, when you're doing registered nursing training, you have a component where you have to do obstetric, which yep. covers maternity care and everything else that happens, including neonatal. And so I was the best obstetric nurse at graduation, and it's something that just occurred naturally. And so when I was placed to go into the neonatal intensive care unit for my first placement, at first I wanted to change. I was like, I loved working with the main intensive care unit, and I was like a go-to nurse whenever they needed somebody to assist them before when mm-hmm. we were doing internship. And so my passion for mothers now developed when I was in the neonatal intensive care unit and pursued midwifery at Kitwe Schools of Nursing and Midwifery in 2008. And after that, came back, was posted to the maternity department where I was working in the postnatal ward. And a postnatal ward in Zambia is very different from the way it is here. Like you have several antenatal women. So like, for instance, on a day, we would have 80 mothers. That
eight,
is...
80.
Yes. Yep. Of those, you would have high-risk antenatal women. Then you would have postnatal women, post-caesarean section, and people that have women that have had normal births in the yep. same ward.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I enjoyed working there, although the staffing levels were on another level. Like if you're working night duty, you will be lucky to have a part-time midwife working with you. Otherwise, you're just alone with all the 80. And of those 80, you have to assess those women that are progressing into labor. Otherwise, you'll be having flawed deliveries if you don't plan your care.
So are this would be open wards, so the old Nightingale type wards where you've got several beds in one big open room, or individual rooms?
Not individual rooms. So you would have three rooms for immediate caesarean section mothers, and then we would have open spaces where we'll have antenatal women, the first part, and then the second part, open space again, with a lot of beds where we would have postnatal yep. mothers, both those that have, they are more than the three post-caesarean section, and women that have postpartum issues that needed attention, because I was at the University Teaching Hospital, which is like the biggest referral hospital in Zambia. Yeah, so it was a very interesting journey, and I loved it because I loved being with women, and I was posted to that ward, I walked in the morning, you know, like you'd I was told by the next unit manager to go and assist with bed making. We didn't even have where to stay because there were floor mattresses everywhere. And so working in that ward as a newly qualified midwife in 2009, I had to implement change. So what I was doing whenever I was on night duty, I would make sure that all the normal beds are discharged in the morning at visiting hours so that we could have space for us to do our work and even for people that are coming in the morning, admissions that are coming in the morning. It was hard at first because the old midwives were like, "Hey, Bupe, we've been doing this for a long time. What is it? What is this change that you are bringing?"
Yeah.
And so, you know, but eventually everybody jumped on it and they would discharge in the morning all the normal beds so that they can go home and then would have space and would even have a breathing space. Because imagine having more, like 80 mothers, of those 80, you would have babies. And yep. For normal beds, they'll be sleeping like four women with four babies on one mattress, just on the floor, you know? So it was that bad. Yeah. And so my strategy started working. And when I moved out of the ward, I moved into administration. I was promoted as a night superintendent. And so when I passed through the ward, I would find midwives discharging early in the morning. In my heart, I'm like, I made it. And so that was one of the things that I did. Then I was also the infection prevention liaison officer. And so what I did with that was ensuring that we had the buckets for hand washing because water is a problem.
Yep.
Luckily enough, what happened was one day when I was working, there was a company that came and they wanted to donate some things. And so they asked what exactly we needed in the ward. And so I mentioned infection prevention gowns. Like even when you go to theater, we used to struggle. We never had gowns. And so they provided us with those gowns and they also provided us with curtains, like screens. The ward, you know, like you would have a lot of women and screens were a challenge.
Yeah.
And so they did work on that and we had screens, we had buckets for hand washing, which was something that I implemented when I was working there. And so I moved into administration, worked there for 3 years. And I loved my work in administration because it gave me more time to work with other projects. So I was attached to the Center for Infectious Disease Research in Zambia, where I was the quality improvement next midwife. Yeah. And so with regards to that project, which I was on, in my team, in the quality improvement team, we were a team of more than 14. We were divided in two districts. And so it gave me an opportunity to get to the hard to reach places of Zambia. And so one of the places where I went to was known as Shikabeta Rural Health Center, which was more than 100 kilometers away from the nearest referral hospital. Mm-hmm. And so it was very interesting because the other day that we had to make a referral. And so you had to go and climb onto a mountain. And this is real. Like I experienced that. So you have to walk from the clinic to a place which is higher, like the mountain, yep. so that you can ring the nearest hospital for a referral. And it's passing through terrains with grass and trees. And it's just on another level. And so my experience working in hard to reach areas opened up my eyes because I was able to feel what nurses and midwives and other health professionals that work in rural areas experience. And so that rural health center only had one enrolled midwife according to the establishment. And then they had one environmental health technician. That's all. So the nurse, the midwife would work like almost 24/7 because if you finish work at, let's say, 5 p.m., if a woman comes in labor, you can't say you have to get back. And so it was really interesting. And so what we did when I went in with our team from CIDES, we were implementing what was we were calling better health outcomes through mentoring and assessments. And in this project, we were training clinical support workers and community health workers, plus traditional birth attendants, because we wanted to shift the practice from traditional birth attendants attending to women during the process of birth to referral agents. Like they had to refer women in their catchment. And so we had to train them into becoming referral agents, and we used to give them incentives. And then we trained clinic support workers so that there was task shifting. Instead of the midwife doing everything, the clinical support workers were able to do everything else, like temperature, triaging and all the other things that were like too much onto the midwife's plate. And so it was a very good project. And then for community health workers, they had their catchments. They had to ensure that people in their area were seeking medical attention and all of that. So yeah, that was my experience at the quality improvement nurse midwife. And so whilst working under the Center for Infectious Diseases Research in Zambia, I was among the healthcare team that was sent to the University of Alabama in the United States of America for a leadership training. So I went there in 2012 as part of the quality improvement team. And it was at the University of Alabama where like my desires to further my education started, because people that were like mentoring us and taking us through the leadership seminars were people who looked like our age mates, but they were professors, associate professors and all of that. Yep. And so they helped us in planning the future. They were like, you need to have your career development plans. And so they took us through that and they kept on mentoring us. So I'd put my plans to say in the next 5 years, I wanted to attend a bachelor's, because I was the training I did was a diploma training, registered a diploma for 3 years. Yeah. Very intense training. If I tell you everything else, you'll be like, is that all? It has to cover like everything, because if you are sent to a rural health center, like the way the enrolled midwife was in Shikabeta, you are everything. There's nothing like, I don't know this. So in the training, it is intense. It's very comprehensive and covers all areas of the facility.
So has it been upgraded to a degree now, or is it still a diploma?
So there has been a lot of involvement with regards to training. So now we do have diplomas. We also have direct entry degrees. And so in different specialties, including neonatology now. So we have neonatal nurses now who are like direct entry. And so in the days that I trained, we only had, either only be an enrolled nurse or midwife, or an enrolled nurse or registered nurse, and then advance into either theater or midwifery. Those were the two specialties that we had. But looking back today, there's a lot that has happened. We have a lot of direct entry bachelor's degrees now for everybody, open to everybody, different from our time where it was post-basic nursing. If you want to have a degree, you have to have a diploma first before you pursue it further. Yeah, so there's been a lot of changes.
Good.
Yeah. And hopefully we're going to align that with regards to competences and the levels of practice, because we have a lot of things that have changed, but I don't think there's been a lot of a change with regards to who does what. So for instance, I trained in South Africa, which was very different. So after I worked for 7 years. After 2013, I went to South Africa to advance in midwifery and neonatal, because I didn't want to go for a general degree, which was being offered by the University of Zambia, which was a post-basic nursing degree. I wanted to continue with my passion, which was mothers and babies. And so after my Alabama trip, I started searching for universities and found a place at University of KwaZulu-Natal and pursued my dream of becoming an advanced practitioner in midwifery and neonatal nursing science. And so that was how I went for my degree, which was called a Bachelor's in Nursing Advanced Practice Program in Midwifery and Neonatal Nursing Science. So I had already gotten my background from Zambia and then crossed over. And so I learned a lot whilst in South Africa, and I loved the program. I loved working in the clinical area because it was very different from my Zambian setup. Like, for instance, when I'm working in a hospital in South Africa, if I'm in the birth unit, there will be all other nursing cadres. There will be an enrolled nurse, there will be an enrolled midwife, there will be a bachelor's nurse midwife, and there will be nurses that have done their midwifery, and then there will be advanced practice practitioners who are midwives that have specialized in midwifery. But everybody of them would have their scope of practice, very different. You wouldn't find an enrolled nurse crossing over doing what they're not supposed to do. If it's an enrolled nurse, they knew to say their role is to do dump dusting, they would clean, they would pack our packs in the birth unit, they would ensure that everything else is in order, you know? Yep. And so levels of practice were very different according to the different cadre, which is something that is taught even in training. When you're in training, if you're a registered nurse being trained, your scope of practice is emphasized in the training process, so that by the time you finish, you would have known what you'll be doing wherever you'll be working. So that if there are litigations, they'll go back to that and say, okay, so you were working outside of your scope. What exactly were you doing? And so I loved that. And it really gave me a lot of insights. So it's in South Africa where I learned about philosophical basis of nursing. And it's something that I've carried at heart since the time that I learned of it. And so I always tell people to say, you know, we always talk about nursing being a calling, but do we even know what that means? And so when I learned the philosophical basis of nursing and nursing theories, I'm like a star. I talk about the philosophical basis, even when somebody says, ah, we shouldn't be doing like that. Nursing is a calling. Me, I'll be like, wait a minute, what exactly do you mean? Because nursing is indeed a calling. But when you look at where it started from, it's because it started from the time that nuns, Catholic nuns, were doing it for attainment of a higher spiritual being. Like the way they do it now, they leave everything to join the convent so that they can attain a higher spiritual being. So that's where the calling aspect came from. So you need to understand where we're coming from for us to defend the profession today. And that lacks in many people. Like, all they know is that it's a calling. And so in 2013, whilst I was in South Africa, there was a strike in Zambia where a lot of nurses were fired and midwives because they were striking.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, 2013. So when I went back, my in-law was like, ah, oh, Wupe, have you ever seen a priest or a nun striking? In my heart, I'm like, So now we are nuns and... Because what they were asking for was something that was genuine, but because people don't understand. And so my wish is that one day I'll be able to stand out there and tell everybody what a calling means and what it entails in this 21st century, because nursing has now evolved. That's why we have a lot of specialties. We even have our own doctors in nursing and midwifery and all of that. But people still consider us as a calling basis that started before the Nightingale era. And now when Nightingale came in, Nightingale was the doctor's helper. And so people still want to carry the Nightingale torch and say we're Nightingales, forgetting that Nightingale just implies that somebody has to give you orders and then you just execute them.
And that kind of brings to mind, we've got Nightingale, Florence Nightingale, but we've also got Mary Seacombe. And if you look at Mary Seacombe, she was much more independent and autonomous in her practice, because kind of Florence refused to take her on as one of her students. Mm-hmm. So she set up her own kind of like hospital, and but she was very much independent in that kind of context. That's really interesting way to think about it.
Yeah. So we need to, you know, I always say we need to understand our profession before people can even understand it. Yeah. And so a lot of people don't understand it. And so like when you look at when it comes to salaries in low and middle income countries, it's like shocking when I tell you how much I was getting before I came here in 2018. My salary was 3,500 kwacha, which was then approximately an exchange rate of $10 Australian dollar to one kwacha. So it was about 350 per month.
Wow.
So, you know, and when you get that money coming from Africa, you have a lot of other responsibilities, not just from within your family, even from other people that are not even related to you. So you have to share the little money that you get and all of that. And that's the practice even today.
Yeah.
You know? And it's because people still think nursing is a calling. So whatever they give you, they feel like actually they've given you too much. And so we need to find a way, a means of ensuring that people understand to say, okay, that's where it started from, and it went through all the other theories. Now we're in the 21st century where it has evolved. It's a profession. And so these people that you're seeing as nurses and midwives, they have a profession now which needs to be remunerated correctly and rightfully, because it's different from the way it was when it was a calling. And there was, you know, when you're a nun, like you can't say much, you are not very much assertive, you are scared your superior will do this and that, you know. So there's that level of discipline that was in the pre-Nightingale era, which continued even in the Nightingale and other theories. But it's very important to learn that we've moved out of that now. We're in the 21st century. Let's give these people the respect that they deserve as a profession. So we need to understand. And one thing that I liked when I was doing that course, we were made to write our own philosophical basis, basing on all the theories that are there. And so you look at everything else, there were advantages and disadvantages in all the theoretical basis. And so you come up with the best. So you get whatever was good in the pre-Nightingale era, you come to the Nightingale era, what was good there and all of that. But again, you have to sieve it. You have to get what was good and what can apply today. Not everything can apply. There are certain things that we need to let go and move on. And that's what we need. And so, yeah, so that was my life in South Africa. I loved it. And now I'm able to defend the profession. So if I hear somebody saying, hey, Bupe, you're a midwife or you're a nurse, you're not supposed to be on strike and all of that, I'll be like, sit here, explain what it means.
can we have a talk? So you then went and did your master's while you were still in South Africa as well.
Yes. So I went to university. So whilst at University of KwaZulu-Natal, I had an opportunity to present in different conferences, and I was given that opportunity. And so it opened a door for me to get to the University of Cape Town. And for my Master of Philosophy in Maternal and Child Health. Also, that one was a non-nursing degree, which has given me the privilege of being a quantitative researcher because I did all the biostatistics. I fell in love with technology. Yeah. And so I always tell people to say, I think numbers matter because I've seen how important it is. Because giving stories, like even like when you're making decisions, people want to hear how many women died from whatever management that was being implemented and what is it that we can do. And so, yeah, so that was how I moved into research, which because my master's was a subspecialty of public health. And I loved it because it was focusing on everything else in maternal and child health. And so we even looked at human rights. It was so beautiful. So whenever I'm talking about babies and mothers, and even when I'm teaching, I'm like, you know, whatever we do, it has to be for the best interest of the neonate or the best interest of the women, because that's part of the law. And most countries have actually ratified most of those things. So we have to practice in that manner and order. And it was all because of my training at University of Cape Town. That is where I learned about human rights and what is involved in that with regards to maternal and child health. So, yeah, that has been my journey.
So what did you actually do for your master's? So what did you look at specifically?
So I looked at sexual and reproductive health knowledge of postgraduate students at University of Cape Town. And so that study was actually influenced by my stay at University of KwaZulu-Natal. So the University of KwaZulu-Natal, Howard College, is on top of a mountain of some kind. And so walking from the residence to the university, I used to meet a lot of students, and like you would meet them in the first year. By mid-year, they would be pregnant.
Ah, right.
Yeah. And so I'll be like, oh my goodness. So when I went for my master's, I was like, what exactly is the problem here? And so I wanted to see how knowledgeable postgraduate students were. Like, will their knowledge be different from those of undergrad? And because most of the studies that I reviewed were just focusing on undergraduate students, so I wanted to have a different perspective with regards to what was happening in sexual and reproductive health. And I was just focusing on about five aspects of reproductive health. I didn't go, it being broad, I didn't want to touch a lot of things because it was just a minor dissertation. Yeah, and so one of the findings was absolutely what I was expecting. Like it was like in agreement with my hypothesis, which was postgraduate students' knowledge will be more knowledgeable with regards to sexual and reproductive health knowledge on contraceptive, HIV. And I looked at pap smears. I looked at contraceptives, which was condom use and all the other things. And I can't remember the fifth one. Yeah, so they were more knowledgeable in comparison to studies that were done in undergraduate students where they weren't knowledgeable. And one of the things that was striking was that they actually learned about sexual and reproductive health in through their lecturers. So their lecturers played a very big role with regards to that. And so always talk about it whenever you're teaching students. They take it as the gospel truth. So, yeah, that was very interesting. And so that was what I did for my master. And it was funded by the National Research Authority of South Africa, National Research Foundation of South Africa for that study. So, yeah.
I think we can underestimate the power of incidental learning. We're looking at something from a bigger picture and we're talking about it in a more global context. But for those who it resonates on a very personal level, that it may be a conversation that you end up having, but because of that conversation, they will go and do a check or something. I had a student, we were talking about miscarriage and how it affects people and how quite often with miscarriage in particular, that they may not share that they have had a miscarriage, whereas stillborn, if they've got to that stage, they had. And I had an amazing email from a student. So this was a big class conversation. And she ended up kind of emailing me and saying, I just want to thank you that after our conversation, I had a big think. And I actually went to my sister-in-law and I apologized to her and my brother for not being there after the miscarriage because I didn't know what to say and it made me uncomfortable. And now, and so now we can talk about it. And they just, all of them ended up with this big tear and hug session. And it was that was nowhere near the conversation that we're having. But yeah, that incidental learning can be so powerful.
Yes, absolutely true. And just going back to the incidental learning, I remember when I was going to the neonatal intensive care unit for the first time, we passed through the departmental manager then, and all she said was, when you get into the neonatal intensive care unit, ladies, treat those babies as your own. Because tomorrow you may not know, you may be the one that will have a baby that will get to the neonatal intensive care unit. And so the care that you are providing today may be given to your baby. Would you like it? So me and my friends, we walked into the neonatal intensive care unit on another level. We would scrub the incubators. And, you know, because the picture is, again, very different from here and from South Africa, because in the neonatal intensive care unit in Zambia can have more than 80 babies. And so of those 8 babies, maybe about 20, 25 will be in incubators and even more depending on the season and how many premature babies we have. And so after discharge, we never had somebody who was employed specifically to clean the incubators. And so we had to do it. And if it comes to birthing the babies, we would birth the babies, just treating them like our own. And I've always carried those words. So even today when you see me working, I always do it like I'm doing it on somebody who is very close to my heart. So, no, yeah.
Totally agree. Same mindset. Very much the same mindset. So apart from the postgraduates having a greater level of knowledge and learning through the lectures, was there anything else that surprised you from the outcomes to your master's?
I'm trying to think through.
It's all right.
I haven't read it in a long time. But, so the people that responded to the survey, because it was sent to all the postgraduate students, and by then I think I was expecting about maybe 1,000 plus. And so the majority of respondents were white South Africans.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it was like, oh, my goodness, how, okay. And, yes, they were female and white South Africans. So, yeah, that was one thing that was, like, striking because the university is, like, very international. There were a lot of other students from other African countries as well, but South Africa topped the respondents, which was good. Yeah, I liked it, and it was very informative. And looking at the results, I just published the paper last year, and I'm yet to go back and read it because I've been busy with my PhD, so I never had
time. That's kind of the next question. Is you've gone from Cape Town, and now you're down under.
Yes,
and you're in Sydney.
Yes.
So how did that journey come about?
Okay, so whilst at University of Cape Town, I started a conversation with Professor Caroline Homer.
Yep.
And so our conversation started. I started the application process because I sent her the email asking for a supervisor. And so she told me to send through a concept note. And my concept note was already ready because I wanted to look at delayed umbilical cord clamping practices from a study that I conducted in 2016, which was funded by the Midwife for Life Award, which I won under the American College of Nurse Midwives. And so I went around 7 colleges of nursing and midwifery in Zambia, where I was soliciting information with regards to the practice of delayed cord clamping. I wanted to see if they were knowledgeable and they were practicing, because once you transfer information to students, it is expected that when they go into the clinical area, they'll be able to practice what they are being taught.
Yeah.
So I already had that background with regards to delayed cord clamping. So I wanted to pursue it further, because it was like 2016 was the time that I went around colleges. And so 2018 was two to three years later. Yep. I wanted to see if there has been that change in practice. Yep. Although at first I wanted to do a retrospective study that was going to look at the prevalence of anemia in children at the children's hospitals in Lusaka, Zambia. And so I wanted to do a quantitative study where I would have looked at the before and after years, before the years of the implementation of delayed cord clamping to the after years, and see if there's a reduction. But when I came in, it was very difficult to find information. There was no studies that were done that had actually published that there were midwives and obstetricians who were practicing. And so I had to get into the prevalence. Now I wanted to see if people were practicing delayed cord clamping. That was how I did the survey when I came to Sydney. Yeah. And so I met Professor Caroline face-to-face in 2017 in Canada, where I went for the International Confederation of Midwives.
Yep.
So I ran through the presenters and I saw her. I'm like, oh, need to meet.
Good way to do it. Yes.
Yeah. And so I sat in her presentation. I enjoyed it. And yeah, I greeted her and told her, this is Bupe. We've been chatting on email and all of that. And yeah, so that was in 2017. And so she was just guiding me on what was needed. And one thing that I'll never forget was her telling me to say, make sure you only come to Australia with full funding. If you don't have funding, it's really a challenge.
Yeah.
And, you know, looking at our salaries back home in Africa, I wasn't going to survive. And so, yeah, my funding was approved, and that was how I came to.
So how did you get your funding, or who did you get your funding through?
So I got my funding through University of Technology, Sydney. So they funded me, so the university funded me, not the government one, the university one.
Yeah, okay. So that was for the whole 3 years or just 1 year?
For the entire 3 years.
The whole program, yep.
Yes. Yeah. And so after finishing my master's, I went back to Zambia and I was working in the neonatal ward. And so being the only master's degree holder working on the ward, it was like, oh my goodness. But I did it with love because I love babies. And so before I finished my program, I've been working with the neonatologist, the only neonatologist Zambia has.
Yep.
She was trained in Cape Town. And so we linked up, and our passion for babies is just on another level. And so we even started a non-government organization, which we call Newborn Support Zambia, spearheading the quality of care of neonates for reduction. We want to reduce the numbers because the neonatal mortality is very high in Zambia, 27 per 1,000 live births. And so it's a lot. And so she told me to say, I know you wanted an office, Bupe, after your master's degree, but babies need you. So you're going to the ward. So I went to the ward and I loved it. And I worked, at first I was just like trying to gauge the environment, because like it had been so many years since I was physically in the neonatal intensive care unit, because I moved into administration before going to school. And so after weighing the staffing and what the challenges were, I now like moved in, of course, in a kind way, trying to bring in change. And I can tell you to say there was change that was seen. Before I went in, like they used to have like a lot of deaths, like 20 deaths per day.
Oh.
Imagine 20 babies dying per day.
How do the staff How do you build resilience to that for the staff? I mean, that's heartbreaking.
I'm telling you, it used to be heartbreaking. So they told me to say, this is the situation. And so I went in, I was like, and it was real. But even before I left, like just a few weeks into the ward, things changed. I started, first of all, making sure that we are appreciating the nurses that are working and the midwives, you know? Even just congratulating them, buying them something if they do something. And one thing that I came to realize was that people love that, you know, not just being told about this and that, but being appreciated. And, you know, like eventually they started reporting. If they are working on duty, like for instance, they're on night duty where we're not there. When I report and they didn't have a death, they'll be like, hey, Bupe, guess what? Tonight we didn't have any death and all of that. And so, you know, and it continued like that. And I would actually make them feel very, very valued and making them feel like they are people that we care for them and all of that. And so it was one of the things. And trainings and even making them know to say these babies, like, for instance, there was one baby we lost. This baby, I followed this baby. They called me to the birth unit because the person who was giving birth was my friend's sister. So I was in the birth unit and she had PIH and antepartum hemorrhage. So no VE was done. And so she had a premature birth and the baby was about 1.4 kilograms. Came to the neonatal intensive care unit. APGAR score was 9-10. So, but you won't believe it that baby died. So when I, like sepsis just came into play, the baby's temperatures were just spiking and all of that. Day three, when I reported for work, I was like going to check if the baby was there. They're like, no, the baby died. I was like, how? You know? And so it was like things like that, like made me sit down and say what exactly went wrong, because if this woman had had VEs in labor during the process of birth, we can say, oh, okay, maybe it could be from the birth unit. Could it be the theater? No, I think that baby had a 9 out of 10 APGAR score, very active and all of that, was put in an incubator and things just changed.
Yeah.
And then we would have a lot of other babies that would come in very active and eventually get septic and just die like that, and you just be watching. And you know, there were certain practices that I never liked, like for instance, they used to put fluids, right, instead of using an infusion pump. We do have infusion pumps. They wouldn't use them, and then they'll be using the big 1 liter
bags.
Bag, yeah. And then they'll be closing, clamping and opening the fluids. So me, I was like, guys, no.
So you can't control the minute volumes that you actually need.
Yeah, and then the time that you actually close it, the fluid is not running. So this baby, we are either sending them into hyperglycemia or hypo and everything. So there were practices that needed to change. And they changed, like I would just sit them down. One thing that I told them was that, remember these babies. And one thing, there was one practice again that I never liked. You know, they used to use bubble CPAP. Mm-hmm. And because you like they don't take time to release the pressure on the nasal bridge. And so imagine there were babies that were having nasal septal defects, like not born with, but hospital acquired nasal bridge damages. And so one day I was like, so how many have you had since the time the bubble CPAP started? One of the doctors was like, Bupe, there are a lot, because they come to the outpatient department to be checked and you see their nasal bridge that was damaged and all of that. And so I asked to say, is it possible for us to be recording so that if we happen to advocate for staffing, we'll have a reason? And the in charge was like, no, we don't do that here. I was just shocked. I'm like, okay. And so it's simple things like that. But I emphasized the point to say, even if you are not the one allocated in the room, if you know there's a baby on CPAP, at least if you can manage every 2 hours, just go in there, release the pressure and then put it in so that we are not having these babies that we are breaking the nasal septal area. And so it changed and they became responsible because I'm sure they were shocked. I was like, you know, pregnancy isn't something that is a joking matter. And so imagine somebody carrying a baby for 9 months baby born with no congenital abnormalities, but just acquired them whilst on the ward, how would you feel if it was you having a baby with a broken nasal bridge, you know? Yes. And so it was from that conversation that things improved massively. There was a reduction in deaths, and there was a reduction in people not being concerned, because there was a day, like, I was still working. Like, I would leave the hospital very late. They would call me at midnight if they need anything. I was that mobile and free. And so one day before I left, one of the doctors was like, "Hey, Bupe, talk to these nurses." They left the baby alone there, and the, you know, the baby aspirated and all of that. And once somebody aspirates in a low and middle income country, you know life is gone.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's that easy. It's that serious and very easy to die. And so, yeah, I used to have chats with them. I used to go for rounds with the registrar. So when they are doing postnatal rounds, they would call me, "Bupe, let's go." So we'll do assessments. We'll pick up abnormalities that were not picked. Like, for instance, just from doing the Ortholan test and all of that. So it used to be very beautiful. So, yeah, I enjoyed my 4 months post master's degree working on the unit. And I did it with passion. And so from that, they saw the need of having neonatal nurses. Though I haven't been able to go back and get involved in the training, I was involved in the curriculum development and identification of stakeholders. We've been working with the Council of International Neonatal Nurses with regards to that. And so we've started.
That's critical. That's absolutely critical. Whether you're leaving your footprints and your handprints, quite literally, yes, on the foundational cement that is going to continue to save lives in the future.
Perfect. Yeah. And so we have now the neonatal trainings, both at degree and master's level and even at diploma level. So, yeah, all because of the impact of one person, Bupe.
So many people and so many clinical staff, regardless of what discipline they're in, think they're so powerless to make change. Mm-hmm. And I know this podcast is, we're focusing on those that are doing PhDs because we're looking at that level. Mm-hmm. But the whole idea is that you can, everyone knows there's multiple problems that exist in the practice and the way that we do things, whether it's the way we do something clinically, whether it's governance, whether it's education, whether it's leadership. Mm-hmm. And all of us have got ideas of how we can fix it. It takes one person like yourself, who's a change champion, who's got the enthusiasm, who has got the let's go and find out how to do it, and has had some of that experience on how to do it in a logical way that sets it up and go, okay, well, this is why we need to do it, and this is what we need to do to help us be accountable and to make benchmarks and to show that what we're doing actually makes a change. And pre and post data collection is so critical. But unless someone sits down and explains it to you and then you can apply it to something, it seems something completely foreign to most people.
Very true. I totally agree. And it's from my experience that I've learned a lot. And, you know, having had the experiences of working in different countries and at different levels, it just gives me a very different context with regards to issues. And so when I sit and talk, I'm looking at somebody who is in a hard-to-reach place. I also have ideas of working in a developed country where you have everything, including all the multidisciplinary team that you need for quality of care. And so, yeah, I'm currently trying to push through the issues of staffing, because that has been a very big issue. You won't believe it that a country like Zambia has got nurses and midwives who are not employed by the government. They've been left out of employment. And so, you know what I did last year? Immediately after they employed the few that they employed, I knew to say these ones were going, the ones that were left out were going through a lot of mental trauma. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so I created WhatsApp groups. So I have WhatsApp groups for nurses and midwives who are not employed in Zambia. So I'm there to encourage them. We are there to share opportunities. When somebody hears an opportunity, they share it. When I hear something, we do like that. And so that's why there was a time when the ICN president posted about low and middle income, developing countries not recruiting nurses from low and middle income countries. I commented on that post. I was like, the picture is not the way you see it. governments in low and middle income countries, despite not having the standard numbers of nurses and midwives on the wards, they still have a lot of unemployed nurses and midwives. And I have them. All of, like, I have
one. I've got an example for you.
I'm just a click away. And I talk to them because I know what they are going through. I just imagine myself finishing a training in 2005 and then no one, like, being willing to employ me because they look like they are saturated with regards to the numbers, but they are not. And what is lacking is the actual, somebody sitting with them and telling them to say, actually, what you need, like, for instance, if a woman is in labor, you need not less than 2 midwives per woman.
Yeah.
And, you know, like that. And when different levels of care, if it's the neonatal intensive care unit, it's supposed to be one nurse or midwife to one baby in the level 3. And then level 2, 1 maybe to 2 and maximum 3. It's not like that. When I worked in the neonatal intensive care unit, we would have 3 to 4 nurses working against 8 babies.
Yeah.
Of those babies, maybe 20 or more than 20 will be on the critical side, which is like level 3. And then you have the level 2s and the level 3. So it's not that they don't need them, but they can't employ them because they've created issues with regards to the numbers and how much the government can afford. And the private sector also is not employing. And so they are unemployed. And so I was like, so if you say no, they can't come to a developed country, you want these people now to just die on their own? Because I do have their number. I'm in contact with them. It's just a click away.
And so are you going to put an application in for the vice presidency of the ICM that's currently being advertised? Have you thought of that?
No.
Well, I think it's a natural progress. You got your PhD now. You've got the experience. I think that's.
I need to start sitting on their boards first. No, I need to start sitting on their boards and then learn a little bit, and then I can navigate. Because actually, what we need is somebody who is very knowledgeable about what happens in low and middle income country, sitting in these big organizations.
Yep.
Because look at what the ICN said, and look. Like if the United Nations says, oh, yes, no one should be employed from Zambia. Meanwhile, we have a lot of unemployed nurses and midwives that have been blocked from getting employed in countries where numbers matter. Because if the lower middle income countries cannot see the importance of numbers, let people go to where numbers matter to beef up the staffing issues as we continue fighting for that. So I want to do what we call workload indicators of staffing needs in Zambia, so that I can give the Ministry of Health the exact picture that is needed with regards to the numbers of nurses and midwives that they need to employ in each health facility. So I'm hoping I'll get funding for that and then give them the numbers and see if they'll be able to implement it. Because what is needed is somebody to just tell them to say, okay, birth unit at the university teaching hospitals, you need, like, let's say, 200 midwives. Neonatal intensive care unit will need this number of nurses and this number of neonatal nurses, this number of midwives, like that, having proper structures. That is what is lacking. And so, yeah, that's what I can say. And hopefully one day my voice will be heard. And yeah.
I'm sure you'll make it heard. That's kind of got me to, like, what's kind of coming next. So let's go back to your PhD. And looking at the delayed cord clamping. So what did you find in your PhD as a result?
Okay, so the prevalence of practicing delayed cord clamping was less than 50%, which was anticipated because many studies that have been done on delayed cord clamping actually attributed the low levels of practice to a lot of other issues that are surrounding delayed cord clamping.
So before we get any further, what's your definition of delayed cord clamping? Because that's something that is still very nebulous in a lot of the literature.
Yes, so I'm going by the World Health Organization definition, which is a delay of between 1 to 3 minutes, which is 60 seconds to 180 seconds. Yep. Practice. Yeah, that's the definition of delayed cord clamping. And so, and you know, pitching, I always pitch my PhD because I've seen how terrible just this anemia can be in low and middle income countries. And, you know, what even prompted me was the death that I experienced. So one of my friends who was a critical care nurse became pregnant in 2016, first pregnancy. She was diagnosed with anemia whilst when she went for her first antenatal visit. And you know how it is just very difficult to correct anemia when you diagnose it, especially in pregnancy, because of the hormonal changes and all the other physiological changes that come into play. And so she was put on hematinics to correct that anemia. And she, months down the line, she went into premature labor. And when she was in the process of giving birth, there was fetal distress. She was rushed to the theaters. The baby came out up very low APGAR score of 310. She started bleeding, so she had postpartum hemorrhage on the table, and then she went into DIC. Mm. Yeah, and so she eventually like died after that because they were trying to transfuse her, but blood kept on coming out because of the issues with regards to clot formation. Yeah, and so I was like, and I've seen it, like, it has no boundaries. Anemia has no boundaries. And so if we are being advised to say just your practice of this 1 to 3 minutes will reduce the lifetime risk of anemia by 60%, why can't we just do it? And so that was what really moved me into doing delayed cord clamping as a project. And so when I did the survey, so I first did the survey, which was sent out to midwives and obstetricians in Zambia. And so I received 239 responses, of which only 40% were practicing delayed cord clamping. Okay. And so that prompted me into doing other studies. So I wanted to find out, because there were a lot of deviations with regards to guidelines that they were using to inform the practice. Because one thing that I've come to realize to say, once guidelines are there, the implementation process of guidelines in the health system helps with diffusion of the intervention being diffused. Yep. And so I wanted to see the type of guidelines. So I contacted birth units across Zambia, trying to collect guidelines that are available. And mm-hmm. so I sent out 100 emails, and of those I received more than 90 responses.
Wow, that's fabulous.
They sent through different types of guidelines. And so when they sent the guidelines, I was like, okay, perfect. So I looked at them. So of the guidelines that were sent, the total were 7. And of those, most of them, like, there was no delayed cord clamping specific guideline or umbilical cord clamping specific guideline. Most of them had just maybe a sentence, maybe a one line to say delayed cord clamping should be practiced like that. And so it was something that is on my plan, actually, as I write the policy brief to the ministry. If we can have delayed cord clamping guidelines, so I'll actually put them like part of the policy brief so that they can just be adapted and disseminated. And so after getting the guidelines, I had to use the agree to and check, even if yep. were just sentences in some of them. Out of the 7 that were sent, I picked the 3 that had information, which included helping babies and mothers breathe and survive. And then there was one which was a neonatal guideline, which also had a sentence. And then there were one protocol which also had a sentence. And so I just analyzed them to see the quality of the guidelines. And they were of good quality. They all scored above 65%, which was good, of the ones that I assessed for, for quality. And then after that, I went further to have face-to-face Zoom interviews with midwives now. So I was focusing now just on midwives, because the surveys had very few obstetricians who responded.
Yeah.
And the reason being, probably in Zambia, maternity care is basically midwifery based, because we have few obstetricians. And like when you go to areas which are not like tertiary institutions, you won't even have any doctor. You just have a midwife.
Yeah.
So I focused more on midwives just to solicit information. And I went into my survey and picked the best units that had at least more than three midwives who said they were practicing delayed cord clamping. And so I went back to those birth units and now had Zoom interviews where I wanted to find out their reasons why they had changed the practice. And for that one, I was using the theoretical domain framework, which really helped me with regards to behaviors that influence people to change. And so it was very interesting. And most of them gave very valid concerns with regards to why delayed cord clamping was not practiced at all in babies needing resuscitation.
Yeah.
And one of the things was because they have to move the baby to another area for resuscitation. Okay. The resuscitator isn't close to the bathing bed, and so they have to move somewhere to go and resuscitate. And so it was understandable. But it was very shocking because there was one person that I had a conversation with who was in one of the hard to reach areas. What he told me was like, where he is, like the nearest referral hospital was more than 70 kilometers from where he works. So there was a day he had a baby with a very low APGAR score of 2 out of 10. Yeah. And so what he did was he just delivered the baby, gave the baby to the mother, delivered the placenta. The placenta was on a receiver and the baby was kept warm on the mother and the blood continued to go to move from the placenta to the baby. And he actually admitted seeing massive improvement and that baby was resuscitated. And that was very shocking. And so the reason why he said he wasn't going to rush into trying to find transport because the road network wasn't very good. And that baby was going to die on the way if they had to rush to a health facility, which was 70 kilometers away from where he was. And so he was like, since then, he's always been practicing delayed cord clamping because he saw what it did to a baby who had a very low APGAR score.
Mm.
Yeah, and so that was one of the things that just struck me. I was like, oh my goodness. So if every midwife can just move on and just start practicing this delayed cord clamping, things will be better. And so there were also concerns when I had Zoom interviews with the midwives. Other concerns were, of course, the issues with regards to jaundice and polycythemia. And so because studies have confirmed to say polycythemia and jaundice will be there with or without delayed cord clamping because it's something that happens physiologically at birth. Yeah. The baby will be born with higher red blood cells, hemoglobin counts, and all of that. And so the hemolysis that occurs in this immature liver will definitely lead to increased hemolysis, leading to polycythemia and jaundice. And so it can happen with or without delayed cord clamping. And so it's just a change of mindset with regards to us practitioners. And if we can just do it, because we've seen how terrible anemia is. If somebody comes to the birth unit, especially in low and middle income countries with anemia, the chances of that person bleeding and bleeding to death are like 90%. And so why can't we just do this in order for us to give this blood, which is the baby's blood from the placenta, back to the baby, just to reduce the lifetime risk of anemia?
And it goes back to that understanding of the physiological process of birth.
Mm.
Having that understanding of, yes, this is actually going to happen, but this is actually the reason why it's happening. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily a bad thing that we have to fix, because it might just take a couple of extra days, but this is actually the process of it.
Yes.
You've travelled around a bit. So, and coming to Australia to do your PhD,
mm-hmm.
did you leave your family and come here by yourself? Did you come with family? How did you, because it's one of the big things of people move to do PhDs, mm-hmm. but it's also very different when you need to move countries, move cultures, move languages, move mm-hmm. by yourself, and then also maintain your sanity while you're actually doing your study when you're socially isolated from your normal support network. So what was your situation in that?
Wonderful. So my situation is that I'm still single, so I have my sisters and my other relatives in Zambia. because even in Lusaka, I used to stay alone. So my focus is just work and work and work and school now. And so I moved from Zambia to South Africa alone again as a loner traveler.
Yep.
So I've been alone and hopefully I'll find someone to marry me. But in the meantime, my only relatives and families are all in Zambia, who are my sisters, my nieces, and everybody else. No parents. So I lost my mom when I was 9 and my dad when I was 15.
So that means you're used to working and living by yourself. So it wasn't just a change of scenery for when you're studying your PhD?
Yes. So I'm used to staying alone and I'm used to making friends. Probably making friends is something that I can say that is my hobby. So wherever I go.
I love that. That is brilliant.
I rely on my friends. So I have friends in South Africa, in Durban. I have friends in Cape Town. I have friends in Lusaka. I have friends in Sydney. Now I'm starting to make friends here in Adelaide. And so that's all I rely on for now, friendship, people that I meet. Yeah.
How did you celebrate when you finished your PhD?
Good question.
Have you finished celebrating, I should say?
I haven't finished celebrating. I still celebrate every day. So first of all, I'm the first person to have a PhD in my family.
Congratulations, doctor.
Thank you very much. So every day has been my celebration because I look back and I'm like, wow, this is Bupe. So being a seventh born in a family of 8.
Oh, wow.
I'm the only one who is outside Zambia. And I'm the only one who is still single with no child.
And but you've been busy, PhD child. Yeah.
Yeah, so I have a PhD child. And so, well, it was, it was like just achieving it has been like a dream come true. And I don't know how I can explain it. It's something that just gives me so much joy. And one thing that I've come to realize is that your background shouldn't determine how far you can go.
Yep.
All you need is being determined, work hard, clap for yourself. And so, you know, one thing, as somebody who has like no one to talk to, like even during my PhD, and so I used to find ways and means of relieving my stress when I'm stressed and all of that. And so I even started doing a lot of shopping. Like every time that I have an achievement, I'll go to TK Maxx or I'll go to shops, get one thing and all of that just to pat myself on the back. Yeah. And so that has been my life. So each time that I go through something, I handle it by myself. Like I usually ask myself to say, maybe if I had a mother, I would like call her and tell her to say, mommy, this is what is happening. But now, like, I've learned to be strong because being strong is the only option.
Yep.
I have no other option but being strong. So even when I'm going through something, all I tell myself is that, Bupe, you know there's nowhere else you are going. You have to be strong because being strong is the only option. And so, yeah.
Are there any other midwifery PhDs in Zambia or are you the first?
There are several. Although there are those people that have been like in service for a long time, I can say I'm the youngest PhD holder in the profession. And so, yeah, that also just gives me a lot of reasons to celebrate because, you know, we're used to seeing very elderly women in their late 60s attending their PhDs.
Yep.
But I've attained my PhD at 42 and I've achieved so much. You know, like sometimes I sit down and I tell myself to say, I think I've achieved so much that a lot of people of my age haven't achieved. My experiences like are vast. Like I've worked in different organizations, different roles. I've been able to manage people. Like the at University of Cape Town, I was the manager for a research site. And so I was employed to just go and help people with regards to reduction of attrition, which was because of just, you know, differences that people would face at work with other people and all of that. And so imagine getting into a place and you're there to act like, you know, somebody that is there to bring peace to the environment. And I can assure you that during my time of working that project, there was only one person who left and it was just something that wasn't supposed to be solved by me, because there were just issues with their stud coordinator. And she was a nurse. She was like, Whoopi, I have to go. This one can't be treating me like this and all of that. Yeah. But like, I went in, I was like, guys, we need to work. We need to be kind. You know, you can't be leaving your work, your home to go and irritate people at work. Huh? Everybody's going through a lot of things. Don't go and put things on other people's. Just be kind. Just one kindness. Before you do anything, ask yourself, if it was going to be done on you, would you be happy? So before you say something to your friend, if it is said to you, would you be happy? If not, don't say it. Keep quiet.
Compassionate. In fact, there's a couple of people who've done studies on compassionate workplaces.
Mm.
We do a lot of work on compassionate care for the women, but it's then turning it around and kind of we need to treat ourselves, in particular our personal selves, but also treat our colleagues with compassion as well.
Because
there's so much kind of already in there. That it's going
absolutely
on. So one of the questions I was going to ask was, and you've already kind of answered it several times because of who you are, but practice changing of clinical practice and policy as a result of all of your research, and you've already explained how little things that you've done within your master's and other little kind of stepping on the wards and seeing things, you've been able to change practice with quite simple methods of educating the staff.
Yes, and it's my passion. Like, I was actually thinking, because one of my friends that is the ward manager for the neonatal intensive care unit was my classmate, and so we always discuss on like a daily basis, and so we talk through things that we can do together and ensure that we're definitely reduce, and I usually receive the numbers of both mothers and babies that are dying every week in Zambia. And so 2 weeks ago, we had 119 neonates who died in the first week of life.
Wow.
And so I was like, what is it that we can do? And because whatever we are doing isn't working.
Yep.
Because if we're losing this number, what exactly do we need to do? So now I was like sitting and thinking. Because sometimes all people need is somebody who is there and just guiding them with regards to what to do. And I think working through issues of competencies is something that is urgently needed, because we have a lot of cadres that have been trained, including PhD holders in Zambia. But if they are sent on the ward, what are they going to do? Just the things that everybody else is doing. So.
Yep.
I've been trying. Like I this afternoon, I was talking to the registrar, who was my senior at nursing school, and so you know, trying to push several agendas here and then, and see if things will improve, and see if we're going to reduce the number of babies and mothers that are dying. And you know, like for the mothers, I tell them to say, you know. Having been an orphan from a very young age, something that I wouldn't wish, not even for my enemy.
Yeah.
It's not something that is good and all of that. And so if we are to do anything possible, let's save these mothers' lives. Losing more than five mothers every week is just something that is heartbreaking. And for me, it just makes my heart bleed, because I just remember myself like as a young girl with no mother, and everybody else around will have their parents, they would call them mommy, daddy, and then you're just there watching, you know, blinking everywhere, because, you know, there's no love like a mother's love. So if you can prevent deaths of mothers dying, that would be great for the future. Because
is that where you get your energy from, that desire to stop that from happening for some babies?
I think so. I think that is where I get my, because I always look at my life and I always look at a lot of other things that maybe would have been better if I never lost my mom. And so I always want the best for others, because life itself, you know, it gives a lot of lemons. And so in trying to add sugar to the lemonade to make it a lemonade, you know, we have to help these babies that are dying every week, if we can save a life, and even their mothers, because these are women that are leaving children behind and who is going to take care of them. And, you know, coming from a lower mid-income country where the government does not support, you know, looking at a developed country, you know, there's that support that the government will give you, the Centrelink and all of that. There's nothing in a lower mid-income country. When your mother dies or your father dies, it depends on your relatives, you know. If they're willing to take you on board, if they understand the importance of education, they'll take you to school and all of that. And life is never the same. And so I always tell people to say, let's try by all means to prevent these deaths that are happening. These women that we are losing every week are leaving a lot of children in pain, and life is never the same once you lose your mom. And so, yeah, speaking from experience.
Yeah. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating talking with you.
You're welcome, Liz.
Thank you for joining us today. You'll find all the links on Twitter, Instagram, and on the podcast website. If you are a midwife and you would like to share your research, your postgraduate studies, or even the quality improvement projects you are doing now, then email me at throughthepinard@gmail.com. Send me a tweet or send me a DM.